Mic one. Okay, now. Yes.
We will also address the issue that has been raised around the two itineraries. But we believe that in the interaction with you, we may have to have a much longer time to go through the specific issues which we raised at the DTI portfolio committee and which we have discussed with the Department of Trade and Industry subsequent to our presentation and subsequent to the DTI portfolio committee hearings which were held in Parliament last month. So probably we'll give you a bit of an update in terms of the way forward around some of those issues. But thank you very much. This is the roadmap. It's a lot of issues, but we'll ensure that we don't bore you with the facts, which are not really speaking to strategic issues. So I'll probably we'll look at the genesis of the IKS, the challenges, the policy mandate. We'll look at the issues of protection and institutional collaboration, knowledge development, and also information and research infrastructure. To begin with, we, in aligning ourselves with the knowledge economy, we have taken up this particular angle of looking at our work, that leadership today is determined by creating and harnessing knowledge. So we see the national office in terms of its role in harnessing and creating this knowledge in the specific area of indigenous knowledge. But we also have taken the position that the ability to convert this knowledge into innovations and wealth will be the determining factor of the wealth of indigenous knowledge. So we are coming from that perspective that eventually we have to be judged by the contribution that we make to the economy of the country, but also to the landscape of the national system of innovation in the country. The probably the genesis of this, we need to acknowledge that in the shifts that have happened in the higher education institution, they've tended to focus on structural and efficient changes. The changes have not really looked at the content, the knowledge. There has been very little discussion as to the knowledge that is taught in the universities and how it should change. Much of the transformation has been with efficiency and realignment of institutions. To that extent, the issue of the emergence of IKS has not come from the institutions of higher learning. In fact, its emergence is linked up with the articulation of the African Renaissance, which is gave rise to looking at IKS as a component of that. Fortunately for us, it's the political elite sitting in this committee when it was the Department of Arts and Culture, Science and Technology, which initiated the institutionalization of IKS in the country. So it came actually from the political elite from here, and we are happy that we can come back and report back where we have taken this mandate that sprung from this committee. So the leadership and the champions were people like Dr. Serote, who were here at that time. And it's seeding. Really, it dates back to 1998 at the University of Northwest as the champion of this. The epistemological shifts, we're talking about the shifts in terms of the content, the methodologies, and the import of this knowledge has really been one of the areas which IKS has challenged. How does IKS interface with other knowledge systems? I thought I should also probably indicate why we think that you're raising this question now as to the debate on the IKS is important. We think that the new moral and cognitive spaces within which constructive dialogue between people and knowledge systems can occur have opened up. There is a more space for us to engage in these issues. But also, knowledge has become an intrinsic nature, an intrinsic part of our democratic society. And there's a lot of discussions around these issues. The role of society in raising issues of governance of knowledge, which is the knowledge politics, has become also an important issue. We cannot discuss knowledge without issues of how it will be governed. And these have been issues that have been raised. The governance of knowledge could be in different forms. The patent system or the intellectual property rights system is one way of knowledge governance. But there are other areas such as certification and accreditation, which are also ways of knowledge governance. The control councils, such as the medical control council, those are areas of knowledge governance. And so these have become pertinent issues of our democracy, how knowledge is governed and to what extent it contributes to national building. There's also the question of the role of knowledge generation in welfare of local communities. So the needs of communities is important. We also have been raising the issues of Africa's continued dependency on knowledge from outside and the perpetuation of intellectual dependency. Does IKS provide us with an opportunity to grow our own knowledge and hence make that as a foundation of building other knowledges on it? There's also the need for new ethics that take into consideration indigenous concepts of justice, indigenous concepts of property ownership. Are these aspects being taken? So we see that in the debates that we're going to engage in, we need to refer to these issues. And that there is also momentum from below. People are demanding that their knowledge must be acknowledged, that their knowledge must be included and integrated in the institutions of learning. But also there is the danger of new knowledge to the continued stability of the earth. Aspects of new knowledge could threaten species. And this needs to be taken in consideration in interfacing with indigenous communities and their existence. And of course, there's a need for an inclusive knowledge network. How do we make IKS part of that? I thought that in looking at the debate, probably these pressures from below, what is happening around us, might be useful to just put that as a backdrop in terms of looking at the debate. I will quickly then begin to look at the policy. I thought that we should do also maybe quickly review what the IKS policy is about. And we put this into tabular form so that we can easily go through it. There are four drivers that have been identified: the affirmation of African cultural values, the development, the developed IKS-based services, and then interfaced with other knowledge systems and the contribution to the economy. The first is attributed to the Department of Arts and Culture, should drive the cultural affirmation. The development of IKS-based services that has been allocated in the policy to the Department of Health, especially health services. Then the interfacing with other knowledge systems, that's where the Department of Science and Technology sits. And the last one is the Department of Trade and Industry. This is how the policy frames the drivers, and the coordination of that is therefore then the National Indigenous Knowledge Systems Office role. The document itself, we have copies of the document in English and four other African languages. Currently they are finalizing the Afrikaans version of the policies. And I'll just quickly take you through that so that we know what it is referring to. The first chapter is what I've already spoken to, the four corners. The second chapter focuses on IKS and the national systems of education and innovation, the integration of IKS in the education system and qualification framework, the integration of IKS in the national systems of innovation, and then the national research and development, the private sector, traditional leaders, and the role of women. And on the other side, I've made reference, but I think we'll keep it for your record. We'll come through and speak to those issues in terms of the areas of debate, which are emerging in those sectors, and I think that we will go through them as we go in, and some of the areas that we've attempted to address. Chapter 3 is the governance and administration, the scope of IKS in government, and the legislative and administrative framework, and the accreditation of IKS. How is it proposed that government should manage IKS? And what are the impediments and opportunities in terms of the legislative landscape? And what about the IKS that falls out of the educational system, IKS that falls out of the national system of innovation? How do we handle it? The proposal is the issue of accreditation. Then the institutional framework, the gives the reasons, but also the creation of the national office on IKS, the creation of an advisory committee, ministerial advisory committee, and the relationship with other structures. And so this is what the IKS policy articulates, gives direction on those issues. Then chapter 5 looks at principles for funding. And it looks at the different categories of funding, and it also looks at areas in which the funding should come, such as SMMS, recent development and innovation at grassroots level, and the support to other organizations and in the skills development. Chapter 6 focuses on the policy and legislative regulatory framework, the local and the international. How do we integrate IKS policy with other national policies and legislation so that IKS does not go it alone? And it is in this context that you also raise the question as the portfolio committee, how does the legislation that is being put on the table with by the DTI also align with what IKS interest groups push as a sui generis? So those alignment issues are important, and the policy does give us a mandate to look into those issues. The global IPR infrastructure, what is happening in terms of the participation in WIPO or in the CBD, and I'm happy to say that Mr. Sukhanandan here was part of the South African delegation to the Nagoya negotiations, which have just concluded. So the DST supports the Department of Environmental Affairs in issues such as that. But we've also been at WIPO looking at indigenous knowledge from that perspective. So to a larger extent, we've been supporting other government departments in those issues. Then the issues of human resource development and capacity building, what and the task that has been given to us, that's Chapter 7. Then Chapter 8, it looks into the IKS information and research infrastructure in the areas that have been indicated below. And then the last chapter is just a conclusion. We believe that in terms of sharing with you, it does give us the framework for the discussion that we are having today and the parameters of the discussion that we have today. So to this end, I just want to, as we go into the policy, share with you 6 challenges that we have identified. That indigenous knowledge systems is an emergent field of scholarship, and as such, it is also multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary. And there are challenges with definitions of these kinds of subjects. I'll take an example of emergent fields, such as nanotechnology or photonics. Those are new areas that are emerging, and they are growing, and it's very difficult to put boundaries on them. So that's one of the challenges that we have in terms of the IKS. There's also ethical issues in looking at the knowledge domain on IKS, and we will come and discuss a little more on that. The contextual rhetoric, this is indeed that the public policy support versus the material support, resources versus the actual commitment, but also the inability to mainstream IKS within the educational system has been one of the challenges. We also believe that indigenous knowledge constitutes a set of beliefs about the world that there is not one, but many forms of ways of knowing. And that is also a challenge, to be able to accept that. The third one is that much of the discussions on IKS have tended to be uncritical. The methodologies that have been used have been a bit more flux. So the challenge is, how do we develop strong methodologies, strong scholarly methodologies that can contribute to the knowledge within that? So we decry the superficial and weak epistemic theories behind IKS. We also raise issues. What is crucial is that scholars pursuing debate on the interfacing of science and IKS should explore the grounds of distinguishing between the different kinds of ways of knowing. The fourth one is the inadequate legislative framework, and this is part of the issue that is on the agenda, that there are limits with the Convention on Intellectual Property Rights protecting indigenous knowledge, but that they are also fragmented legal instruments that are used. If we look at the environmental protection and the related indigenous knowledge, we look at the NEMBA regulation and the Department of Environmental Affairs and the bioprospecting regulation. When we're looking at intellectual property rights protection, we look at the Department of Trade and Industry as the driver. And when we look at innovation in research, we're looking at the DST with its publicly funded Intellectual Property Rights Management Act. And so all these kinds of frameworks that are there need to be harmonized. And one of the challenges that we have is that harmonization of the legal instruments that we have. We have come to the conclusion that there are inadequacies in terms of the provision for the protection of indigenous knowledge systems. Finally, probably, the last two, one is in the inelastic knowledge governance structure. Limited challenges to the architecture of Western hegemony. This is not just a problem within the country, it's a global problem. What are the alternatives that we have to the knowledge hegemony that has been exercised over the last 200 years from the West? So that is a challenge that does not only affect IKS, it's a universal challenge. But also, when we look at issues of IKS, the others who dismiss it, that it's not knowledge. So we need to find a way of putting in a rationale, an explanation, and strong academic explanations of what constitutes knowledge, but who decides what this knowledge is. We look at the National Qualification Framework. The issues of indigenous knowledge systems have fallen outside of it. We look at the national research funding for a longer time until this committee put aside dedicated funding. It wasn't part of the mainframe, but it is the funding which came from the portfolio committee which elevated IKS into the National Research Foundation funding. But if we're looking at access to that funding, until 2 years ago, it was only academics. Knowledge holders could not access that knowledge until we reviewed that policy. So that in terms of research, research is not only done in academic institutions, it's also done in communities. How do those communities get empowered to access those resources? So that formulation, we worked with the National Research Foundation and acted together. The Medicines Control Council, these are the institutions of governance I'm referring to. How flexible are they to take into consideration the demands of indigenous medicines? We look at issues of intellectual property rights regimes, the current debate of saying what is it that is being put on the table as amendments by the Department of Trade and Industry, and what are the alternatives of sui generis. It's those issues that also issues of governance. If IPR is only determined from one perspective, what about the perspective of others? So the knowledge governance issues are very important, that whatever knowledge is produced, if these governance institutions are not flexible, it becomes quite a challenge in the way forward. And finally, we talk about knowledge management and social networks. IKS is embedded in people. IKS is reproduced through social networks and living. How do we tackle issues of this? So we need to look at issues of knowledge management. And around this issue, there's issue of databases. We did hire, I heard that there's someone from KPMG here, we did hire KPMG to do a national audit on databases on IKS so that we have a basis to know what is in the country around that. So the challenges on how to manage this knowledge. We've been just discussing in terms of our Information Act, how, to what extent will we be able to determine and keep out of the public domain knowledge that is sacred, and that is sacred within indigenous communities. Do the two speak to one another? Is there a provision in which some of this knowledge can be protected from that perspective? So all those are issues that should be placed in the public domain. So I thought I should just begin to introduce some of these key areas of knowledge management, knowledge development, and knowledge governance. And I think that the word of knowledge governance needs to gain more currency. How do we govern IKS within the country? It's an important aspect which must also be paired with traditional leaders. How do they play a role in this area of knowledge governance as custodians of this knowledge? So the issue of knowledge governance is a big issue that we need to really begin to turn our attention to in terms of the debate, the roles, and whose responsibility that should be. Well, we probably get now into the specifics about the work that we're doing and the issues and the debates that are arising out of that, make this transition. We maintain that the role of the office is to nurture the IKS priorities through proactive engagement in the field of science and technology. We are not in every part of it. We will not be found in arts and culture. It's not our role. Our role is in the interfacing of knowledge systems. We will assist our colleagues in the Department of Health in terms of the research in indigenous knowledge medicine, but we are not providers of services. We will not provide a hospital or an integrated hospital. It's not our role as DST. Even when we interact with our colleagues in the Department of Trade and Industry, we have to provide the proof of concept. And then they take it up in terms of rolling out industries and whatever comes out of it. So we need to create our boundaries in which we operate. We cannot be everything in IKS. We partake a particular space in which we work as our mandate from the DST. On the policy debates, we thought that actually the biggest policy debate at the moment is the protection of IKS. There are issues of biopiracy that emerge. There are issues from the ground of unfair exchange between those that produce biological materials. A good example is that of Palagonium, where the patent was revoked in January this year, and the communities that produce there, and there are complaints that they are not paid well. So there are pressures that are arising out of that. So we thought maybe we should do just look at what are the issues around this issue. The first one is really the definition of indigenous knowledge or traditional knowledge, which are used interchangeably. The second one is who should benefit from this particular exploitation or protection of indigenous knowledge. What are the objectives that are sought in terms of using intellectual property rights protection? What are the economic rights and what are the moral rights? What forms of behavior in relation to the protection of IKS should be considered to be unacceptable and illegal? Should there be any exceptions, limitations, in terms of approaching the protection, the legislation of IKS? For how long should the protection be accorded? These are debatable issues to what extent do existing intellectual property rights already afford protection, and what are the gaps that need to be filled? Are there assumptions that can be applied, and which issues require international and national treatment? And these are issues which have also arisen in the discussion with the Department of Trade and Industry. So we are hoping that by focusing our attention on the challenges, the debates around these issues, we will look at that. Our participation in the WIPO activities have also informed that these are the same issues. If you are following the discussions in Nagoya, the OCPD negotiations was delayed and bogged down around the issues of beneficiation. Who should be the benefits? How should we define issues of illegal use and misappropriation? So these are critical issues, not only significant to South Africa, but significant globally. And so we thought that we should just put them around that. We have raised the issues as well of intellectual property rights in terms to the genetic resources. The Department of Water and Environmental Affairs have put in place regulations. And I'm glad to say that in terms of indigenous knowledge in that, we've been responsible for drafting Article 8, Chapter 6 of the regulations. And we've been working with our colleagues, but that responsibility they gave to us. So we cooperate and work together with other colleagues. We, in terms of the role of customary laws practices in relation to the protection of genetic resources, we have recently also opened up discussions with the National House of Traditional Leaders. We've been to their forums to share with them in terms of what is the latest issues that are happening and how could they play a role in knowledge governance. So we hope that we'll continue that discourse with them. Well, there are other issues of disclosure of origins in terms of this. To a certain extent, the amendment to the patent laws in 2005 did include issues of disclosure. But that is one instrument of the intellectual property rights patent law, but not the others. And those are important issues to note in the discussions around how the amendment should act. It applied only to one instrument, which is patent law, and not to copyright, and not to trademarks, and not to designs. And these are important items that need to be taken note of as we look at the issues of intellectual property rights. The issues of the certificate of origin in terms and the prior informed consent are issues that are still pertinent. In the debates on Nagoya, they were still important. The issue of establishing a competent authority that can manage and monitor these activities was debated. And it's not in the interest of Western countries that have a free reign and access to biological resources to have that established. So they objected to that. So it's no longer part of the protocol which was agreed upon in 10 days ago, because then it allows room for maneuver by pharmaceutical companies and other people that want to exploit indigenous knowledge. So those are issues that we need to be factoring in as we look at what is contestable within the country and globally. And of course, the issues of prior art in terms of the work that we're doing, this is going to be a very interesting aspect of the work that we do in. If we were to look at the models that are available, the Chinese have had this knowledge for centuries in book form. So did the Indians. So all that they need to do is publish this material or keep it into the traditional knowledge digital library as the Indians, and it's already in the public domain. So prior art, because it's already conformed into that, can be used therefore as a defensive mechanism to protect their knowledge, as was in the case of turmeric. They could prove that this is has been an Indian knowledge for centuries, because it's already conformed in that. But ours is oral. The knowledge is too oral. how do we then turn it into such a form that it becomes prior art for us to make it defensible? So these are challenges that we need to address in looking at the scope of protection of indigenous knowledge, which is oral, which is not in the public domain. And how do we move around that? And the issue, looking at some of the current issues, there's the effectiveness of establishing funds. We participate in the bioprospecting expert group at the Department of Environmental Affairs. They've set up a fund. So when people apply for licenses and there's some benefit sharing agreements and they have funds, they quickly begin to distribute the funds to the beneficiaries. The Department of Trade and Industry is also proposing a fund. And how do we, as a government, begin to look at these funds from one perspective so that the beneficiaries are able to say, no, this is the policy framework around the country? So it's those issues that we are saying need to be aligned. We need to think about them. I think that probably to a larger extent, the issue that this slide is raising is to say that the other intellectual property rights instruments, such as copyright, designs, and trademarks, as well as the Performance Protection Act, and all these, we need to look at how do they interface with IKS. It is not just the four that have been picked out in terms of the DTI process. There are more of these legislation that need to be comprehensively looked at. And so to that extent, our position is that this is possible. It's a question of maybe the languaging of what they've put on the table and getting to look at the issues as a united government position. And to that extent, that's why we've opened up discussions with the DTI. We're meeting on the site to say, in terms of the way forward in the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry, how do we put our minds together and clear the whatever is the backlog? So at that level, we are definitely seeing from our same perspective. Probably a couple of more issues. This particular question has been raised between intellectual property rights and sui generis. In the manner in which intellectual property rights is conceived, it's mainly for commercialization, it's for economic benefits. If we were to look at the protection of indigenous knowledge from only a commercial benefit, we will lose the moral and social rights, which require the protection and preservation of those. The issues of sustenance of communities are deriving from the indigenous knowledge, and all those aspects are not around commercialization of indigenous knowledge, but they are needed for protection. To what extent can we have a more holistic and comprehensive regime? That is probably one of the major points that needs to be re-looked at in terms of the debate on the issues. And I'm glad that the way the question has come from the Portfolio Committee is to say, what are the debates in this area? I think that what we're doing is to outline the different perspectives that are emerging within the country, but globally around these issues. Probably the point that has been raised, and I must come to this point, is that every one of these instruments called intellectual property rights evolved separately. There's no one coherent philosophy that initially emerged. So each one of them has evolved differently to look at the different particular needs. And that's what we look at. Are the trademarks, it arose in a different context of protecting the different symbols that, or example, it would be the Coca-Cola is a trademark. It's a brand. it looks at a different kind of thing. Patent looks at the knowledge that is contained and how that knowledge could be. And so they evolve at different kinds of time and needs. Industrial designs refers to the different kind of requirement. Copyright is a different kind of requirement. So all these are lumped under what we call intellectual property rights. The question is, these are bundles of intellectual property rights. To what extent should the indigenous knowledge stand alone as a bundle of intellectual property rights? That will then cover the different aspects of that. So this is the kind of debate that is existing. Should we infuse indigenous knowledge in this bundle, or should it stand alone as an additional right in terms of the protection of indigenous knowledge? So to this extent, the discussions at WIPO and the discussions at the CBD, they are arguing for the emergence of a new right on indigenous knowledge. And the Group B countries and associates maintain that there's no need for the new rights to emerge because these current rights are adequate in covering the indigenous knowledge. But we could demonstrate that this bundle of intellectual property rights provisions would not be adequate. A trademark is a trademark. It doesn't go beyond that. Patents have limitations. There are three criteria that they use. But the most important criteria is novelty. Now, how do you look at indigenous knowledge which has been generated from generation to generation over centuries to look for novelty? The second part is industrial application, that it must have an industrial application. We cannot argue that every aspect of indigenous knowledge that we are trying to put will have an industrial application. So there are issues within the patent law itself, the criteria that is used, which limit the forcing of indigenous knowledge into that area. However, should a science council take a particular traditional medicine and take it into thorough research up to the molecular level, they can register it under the patent. But if it's a traditional knowledge holder who says, this is my knowledge that I have, it cannot be protected because it has no novelty. The only novelty that can be found is if they find a particular active ingredient, which then becomes a particular molecule that leads to being recognized as a novelty. So there are these kinds of limitations in the intellectual property rights that we have. Industrial designs, copyright, they are all limitations. For copyright, it's not the knowledge that is in the book that is protected. It's the form which is the book that is protected. So that knowledge, once it's reduced to a book, even if it is a book on indigenous medicines, that knowledge is not protected. It's the reproduction of that knowledge in the form of the book that is protected. So we are saying that in terms of looking at the challenges of the current intellectual property rights, there are limitations in what it can protect in indigenous knowledge. And therefore, we need to find and debate what is the appropriate way of making provision for this indigenous knowledge to be adequately protected. And probably that refers to this slide. Should it be this box that we are looking at in terms of the protection? Are the bundles of protection. We thought as well that probably we could give this slide as a way of trying to distinguish some of the work on intellectual property rights. Intellectual property rights is really arisen as private rights to that knowledge. And on the other hand, when we look at the ownership of indigenous knowledge, it's a collective, communal, societal kind of issue. So we thought that maybe if we just share with you a bit around some of the distinctions of the approaches, would probably begin to see the debates around the issues. It's about economic rights, about individual ownership, but also for a limited term. How do we begin to look at intellect of the protection of indigenous knowledge, which has moved on from generation to generation, and we reduce it to a 20-year period or a 30-year period according to the current IT regime. So that are the challenges. And then the tools used, and we've just looked at the issues, the bundle of intellectual property rights, and then the criteria that are used. On the other side, on the sui generis, is that it covers both the economic, the moral, and also the social or customary benefits that come with it. That it still honors the issues of collective ownership, but in terms of the period, it will have to be in perpetuity, as long as the communities use the knowledge for their own livelihood, as long as the communities use that knowledge for the different technologies to improve the qualities of life, that knowledge needs to be protected. If it falls out of use and becomes obsolete, or then there's no need for protection. But if people and communities still need it for their livelihood, there should be a need to protect it and to protect them from people to expropriate it from them. And we looked at the different tools that could be used. We've already talked about the Indian Traditional Knowledge Digital Library. That's the databases. How do you use databases as a method of protection? We have also looked at the genetic resources in terms of the provision for that. In the discussions that we've had with the amendment bill to the DTI Portfolio Committee, there hasn't been a focus on the genetic resources. How can we afford to leave such a major source of future wealth creation out of protection? So these are issues that we are saying it is crucial for a holistic approach. So it takes into the social, the economic, and moral aspects of it. Indigenous knowledge cannot only be protected for commercial purposes. For social cohesion, in terms of rituals and rites and ceremonies of people, they need to protect that so it is not abused. And all those things fall under the moral rights. And to what extent do we create a holistic framework that does not only operate from the economic perspective? Probably I spend a lot more time on these issues because they are the issues that were highlighted that we need to raise them. But we also have a much more detailed body of presentation specifically around that issue. But we thought we should summarize it in this way for the benefit and to put the debate on the table with this committee. I will shift my gear into other work of the DST department. One of the roles that we looked at was how do we coordinate government activities within IKS work. So we have a responsibility on institutional collaboration. There is an interdepartmental committee with probably at the moment 14 government departments, including the South African Police, South African Revenue Services, as part of this committee. How do we begin to see how IKS is handled within government? So we have taken that lead, we coordinate those activities, and we meet 3 to 4 times a year to look at what are the policy directives at the national level. We must also maybe probably acknowledge that when it comes to international negotiation on the protection of indigenous knowledge, we have also taken responsibility. We provide the leadership at WIPO when it comes to the TK and genetic resources negotiations. So we have played a role in collaborating and coordinating activities. We write country positions on issues of CBD. We submit that to the Department of Water and Environmental Affairs. So we've been playing that role. Whenever it has any impact on traditional knowledge, we've played that role. When the traditional leaders' governance framework was being developed, we also, from that perspective, made commentary as part of our responsibility as the DSD. So we see that as our role in creating this institutional collaboration in the activities that we have been given. So to that extent, I think it's an important to begin to say the role that we are playing as NICSO. Could it be played better if we were a standalone institute of indigenous knowledge that then transcends the boundaries of departmental mandates and creates a national mandate? Those are issues that we're looking into the future of in NICSO. We need to be looking at is it better positioned when it's located in a government department, or is it better positioned when it becomes a coordinating role of these activities? That is probably a discussion for another day, but as we look into the future, it's probably important to see those needs. The IKS research ethics, we know that a lot of new researchers that are emerging that have to be dealt with, and there are many other research around biopiracy and all that. How do we develop a research ethics that takes into consideration these protection requirements that we're talking about, these benefit requirements that we're talking about, these confidentiality requirements that we're talking about? So we are about to finalize our research ethics for IKS research by the end of the year, so that we can begin to manage this. The examples will be when we get into a community, to what extent does the ownership of such research become a community responsibility and the researchers, moving away from the model where there is a researcher who knows all and the subject who only provides the data. Can we move beyond that? There's all research protocols that needed to be done in communities, which probably we need to know. How do we respect communities which are participating in this? So this slide is around those kinds of work to indicate that these mandates that we have needs to be wrapped up in principles which should govern everyone that works around that. So we are happy to report that this is moving quite quickly. I must say that the chair of the portfolio committee was a living witness to the success of the National IKS Expo of 2010 in Devon. This is the third one that we've done, and I probably will not be blowing my own horn by saying that probably it was of world-class quality. We had participants, observers from China, Chinese delegation. We had also a delegation from Uganda, Department of Education. So to a certain extent, this flagship is meant to reach knowledge holders, to provide a forum, not for the academic institutions alone, but for the knowledge holders of the community.
Sorry, sir. You have forgotten the U.S. delegation.
Yes.
The came with director of the University of Northwest.
Thank you very much. See, that's the benefit of involving the portfolio committee in the activities. Thank you, sir. So we really just highlighting that that's a part of the policy development. There is more substantial work that additional substantial work that we're doing. The policy framework, we cannot just live on policy. We have to, the policy assists us to frame the work in which we're doing. This particular work now begins to look at how does indigenous knowledge contribute to the work of science. So this particular slide on research, IKS research and development, focuses on the methods of research management that we've developed with the NRF, and I'm glad that Rob from the NRF is here, so at least he can bear witness that we have a new model of research where we make a call not only to national research institutions, but also to individual knowledge holders. We have also probably developed, in terms of moving from basic research to applied research. We are trying to move away from the 10 years which came from funding from the portfolio committee through the NRF, which was spread in all areas of activities, we're trying to concentrate that funding. How does it go towards applied research, which will lead into proof of concepts and eventually into product rollout that can contribute to the economy? We do not want to do research for the sake of doing research. There is a place for that, but at this moment we think that the research should be directed towards the issues of product development. We've also probably, this is an interesting area which we're looking at, ICAST curriculum studies. One of the mandates in Chapter 2 is that we must find a way of integrating IKS into the educational system. And we are happy to say that we, together with SAQUA, the University of Northwest, Venda, and Popo, we have developed a Bachelor of Indigenous Knowledge Systems, registered it with SAQUA. We are hoping that come February this coming year, the first enrollment at Northwest University will be will happen. And the reason why we moved from a Bachelor of Arts with major in Indigenous Knowledge is to make this degree in Indigenous Knowledge Systems a professional degree. It's a four-year degree. And the final year will be away in the field, applying the knowledge that they've accumulated. We also move probably into, away from these issues of curriculum studies and epistemologies. We'll talk about them probably a little more later. We've also moved into research in medicinal, food, and nutraceuticals. We've tried to say what is beneficial from the food that our ancestors have grown. How can we break down the nutritional value of that? Just as an example, in this year, the United States of America have tried to patent sorghum from Ethiopia so that they can then prevent everyone else from the use of sorghum, because it becomes their patent. You must then license from them to produce seeds for sorghum. And the reason is that this is an indigenous food which has nutritional value but also climatic value. And what do we do with our own foods, the madumbes and others? We need to actually subject them to further and thorough study to look at their nutritional value and the like. So it is important that we do mention some of this. A platform has been established, and there are people that are working on that. Amaranthus, as one of the vegetables, that is that, is very rich in vitamins. How do we take that? The different vernacular names of Amaranthus, apart from Moroho.
Well, in Shanghai it's called Czech. I'm not sure about other languages.
But it's very rich in vitamins. Can we turn this into a household? Because it's easy to grow. It grows wildly. How can we make it part of a nutritional value to our food? There are technologies as well, so let me just move on. This particular slide, I could have spoken to it in a different way, but in the human capital development, this Bachelor of Indigenous Knowledge is just one aspect of it. We've established a chair at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in African Traditional Medicine. We are hoping that with your support, we can grow that from a chair into the school of African traditional medicine. And I think that the vision must not be limited to a chair. We need to grow it into a school of African traditional medicine. We also have placed a chair at the University of Water Sisulu on in systematizing and codifying indigenous knowledge systems. To what extent can we develop our knowledge to the same level as other world knowledges? So a particular chair that interrogates and invests its resources and students in examining that. The chairperson has been to the IKS laboratory. I tiger that here at MRC. It's a state-of-the-art laboratory on indigenous knowledge systems. And we're doing a second one at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. The premises are excellent, and we hope that we can continue with that. The CSSR Biosciences and the MRC are all working together with us in the bioprospecting platform. So all those facilities are available for use in the development of human capital. The MRC have got postdocs that are helping them at the Tigerbet Laboratory to supervise other junior, and we're putting in funds from the DST to support that activity in the human development. And as much as we are also putting money in the other universities for masters and PhD studies. So we're hoping that we will contribute to the human capital development within the scope of IKS. This was probably a capture of some of the visits in that center there, if I can succeed. That's the minister visiting the laboratory at Tigerbet. We've also had the portfolio committee prior to this one visit the laboratory. We had discussions in the laboratory with the portfolio committee to see what it is that is being done in that area. Well, I probably last comment is that this work that I've been referring to has been integrated in the 10-year DST innovation plan. The DST innovation plan has got five grand challenges. One of the grand challenges used to be called farmer to farmer, but we're translating that into the bioeconomy. And those three flagships are already integrated as part of the DST general mandate around that. Traditional medicine, cosmeceuticals, nutraceuticals. I was going to indicate that at the level of cosmeceuticals, we have products which have gone through the proof of concept to deal with boarding and mouth health hygiene, which we should be able to find investors to roll out as. So for anti-boarding and they claim, I have not yet tested it on myself, but they claim that there's also an anti-aging agent in one of these activities. So we'll have to wait and see to what extent
sorry,
that is moving.
Sorry, Prof, on that. How then do you wonder to why the anti-aging if you have not tested it? Because you are to say, look at me. I've been using it.
I bet I'll subject myself to the subject of research. No, thank you very much. Probably more specific, I think that it is good for the South to know the a little more details. We're working on diabetes and strong relationship between the province, Limpopo province, the University of KwaZulu-Natal in a specific area of diabetes, HIV/AIDS, we have actually a number of products. The University of Western Cape is at the point of getting into clinical trials at level 3, and the University of MRC itself has got also products that they are putting on that. For the first time, we have a plant-based tuberculosis lead that the Department of that the Council for Science and Industrial Research are pushing, and then there are aspects as well on asthma. So we are trying to open up from the knowledge holders and come up with the issues that contribute to national health priorities. I talked about the hair loss, the skin care, the oral products, and the fragrances. I just want to probably indicate, most of you know in paper, which is banned by traditional leaders, healers, trust for blessings. It has been taken into research, and an essential oil has been extracted from that. So it's one of those elements that then we will need to test the toxicity of that essential oil, and thereafter then move into its use. And they say that it has health benefits. To what extent can gyms, where people go running, use it as a fragrance in their gym? So we're looking at different applications of these people apart from the spiritual aspects of it. So that's the kind of work that is going on in this area. There is a tea that has been found in Rustenburg, which could actually begin not to compete with the rooibos, but to supplement rooibos. And it's under clinical, under laboratory test at the moment to see whether it will also make it. It has, that one, ma'am, I've tested. it has quite some lovely taste. Well, these are the questions that we are asking about this particular work on the bioeconomy strategy. The South African commitment to the bioeconomic strategy match the funding, infrastructure, and human capital needs. Yesterday and today, there is a consultative discussion in Pretoria around those issues. How do we begin to make specific funding needs, infrastructure needs, and human capital needs in order to make the bioeconomy come into reality? We're also looking at innovation and how it is open to exploitation, and we say we need to put in protocols. And how ready are we to put in new protocols? And how ready are we to put in new methodologies? The question of the institutionalization of IKS, we have taken a stand, Chair, that unless we build institutions in the national innovation system that speak to IKS, IKS will disappear. So that's why we've pushed in for chairs, centers of excellence, laboratories, so that these are physical things that are seen as representing IKS in the landscape. So we take seriously the issue of institutionalization of IKS as an interfacing mechanism in the national system of innovation. I raised this question already, whether Nixo is placement in the DST in terms of program 4 or program 2, but this is an internal aspect which I think that need not bother you at this level. I have two last areas to look at in terms of the presentation, the knowledge management aspect and the issue of epistemology. On the knowledge management system, we have thought that we should build a national recorder system because our knowledge is oral. We should record it. And we've made a lot of progress. We've decided to use the University of Zululand as a pilot, set up an IKS documentation center there, with communities as far as Umhlanga Walingana, with the border post with Mozambique, and then in Kandla, as another site. So we are at the moment piloting the collection of information from those areas. And the Meraka Institute is busy establishing infrastructure to do the pilot. So by the end of March 2011, we should have one phase completed, which we should demonstrate as to how it will work. But ideally is that this should be a national structure. We've entered discussions with the Department of Trade and Industry on their presentation on databases. Could this be the national database that brings in the Department of Communications, the Department of Environmental Affairs, CIPRO, and the Department of Arts and Culture in one database? And that's at the moment is the direction in which we are going. We've had discussions with all the mentioned players in using this as a national resource. Probably I will not give the details, but this is just a model of who should be involved and what it should be doing. But I think I've given the important part of it. We have been developing a national policy on database protection. The Human Science Research Council has completed the development of that, and I think they submitted that report. We will take it up for national discussion after it goes through the minister's office. The reason why we're looking at this is that there are very intricate issues in the protection of databases. Should we use public funds to collect this knowledge and we put it in this database, we think that this knowledge needs to be protected in terms of access because there's potential for intellectual property rights, there's potential for regeneration and sustenance of communities, there's potential for economic activities. Now, if it is protected, it's been developed by public funding, the current laws that are in the country is that anyone can demand access to the information. What then happens to the protection of that information? So those are issues that the database protection policy is raising terms of the protection of indigenous knowledge systems. There are specific requirements that should apply to the protection of this knowledge. Do the other laws allow for such protection of indigenous knowledge? So this policy, when it comes out and is debated nationally, will get input around that issue. There are issues of standardization of the information that we collect, metadata that speaks to how this information should be collected, so that when the department, when CIPRO wants information, they can get it in a usable way. When the Department of Communication wants this information, they can get it. So we need to standardize this and have one template from which we can work. The location of this database, where should it be located? The language issue, should it only be in English, or how do we translate it in other languages? So there are quite a number of issues that are important. The authentication and verification of this knowledge. How does such a system provide for that? We've been thinking through a lot around these issues, and we think that the secret lies in the communities where the knowledge is coming through to authenticate whether that knowledge is true. For validation, we've also been thinking about that. There's a validation in the laboratories, but there is a validation in the laboratory of life. If a remedy has been used for generations and it has proven to be worthwhile, isn't that validation? So there are those issues around the issues of databases. We have started the new work, and that has also raised a lot of debate. I have happened to be very fortunate. I've traveled with the National Heritage Council on the development of the Heritage Transformation Charter. One of the issues that they had put on that agenda was the place of IKS, and every province and every community, they said, we are also educated. We also have knowledge, but you don't respect us because you only use a system that respects Western knowledge, the certification through the schools. How do we cater for the recognition of knowledge holders outside the educational framework? And so we have started a discussion on the accreditation and certification of indigenous knowledge holders and practitioners. Can they establish communities of practice which can then set up standards for themselves? And then within this community of practice, they will be able to certify one another. A good example is in traditional healing. The traditional healing, they go through a schooling system. They have standards which they have amongst themselves. And there are different qualifications that they have. You can specialize in this disease, or you can specialize in element in maybe the universe. And then you're not a Sangoma, you're a Mungoma. You're above many of these issues. Can we find a way in which we can discuss and find standards and then certify people as having attained those standards within their own knowledge systems, with themselves determining that, but providing a framework from a government perspective? We think it's a very exciting piece of work. If we succeed, we'll be the first one to have established such a system.
That's a follow-up on that. I just wanted to remind you to at least to inform the committee from the expo. One of the, I can't remember his name, the one who was talking to the conference, that he's one of the people who evaluates. You remember the traditional healers? Yeah, who, I can't remember the name, but he did give standards, the procedure that they use, and some of the people that they who were lying, they were found not to qualify, and so they were dismissed.
Dr. Maseko is a leader of one. There are probably two or three big traditional healers associations in the country. Dr. Maseko leads one based in Gauteng, and he was testifying to the fact that they are very thorough ways of training people, and they are able to tell quacks from real people. And so this is the kind of issue that we are raising. If they have been able to do this, how do we formalize those kinds of things so that they do regulate? If they have to have access to the public health system, to the insurance, to health insurance, could this be a system that could assist us in, saying this one is a journey and this is a certification number? So this particular activity will definitely have put Dr. Mayeni from the Department of Health as a leader in this area, so that the intergovernmental nature of our work is actually manifest in the way we operate. So that's the future work that we've started. We should provide a framework, a concept document, by the end of the year in terms of where we're going. The last bit is too academic, but I'll summarize it. But in the knowledge production over the last 200 years, there have really been three major currents that have led to shifts in the way the knowledge is produced in terms of the politics of knowledge production, which we refer to as epistemologies. But for long, there's been a universal construction of knowledge, which has been based on a tradition that emerged within Western societies, which tended to claim that knowledge can be objective, and therefore you can subject it to different kinds of tests, it will come out to be the same. A fact is a fact. The kind of template that this knowledge has produced has tended to be reductionist, in terms of its approach to knowledge. It fragments. Let me take an example. In ways of knowing, in an African context, when you put a medicine together, they look at the efficacy of that medicine as a holistic thing. They will not try and isolate, say, which of these molecules did that. But in a Western approach, you have to reduce your knowledge. That's what we call reductionism. You have to move from the whole to reduce it to which molecule. So the knowledge approach to knowledge production has tended to be reductionist and fragmentary and not holistic. This is a very simple way of trying to project that. The second one is the exclusion of all other knowledges in other societies and not being essential unless they conform to a Western way of evaluation and assessing knowledge. So there's been a Western discourse that has projected their knowledge system as superior to any other knowledge system. That there's been also a process of keeping other information, other knowledge as primitive or uncivilized. So this particular approach is being referred to as a universal construction of knowledge, which claims the universality of objective facts. Now, a second move has tended to move from the social construction of knowledge, which is a movement towards the end of the last century. Can you imagine? Can you talk about the last century? Which says that knowledge is a social construct. It is constructed in the relationships, power relationships, social relationships. So the fact is not just a fact. It has relationship to other factors. And this particular discourse has tended to unravel the dominance of the Western knowledge construct by saying that knowledge production, because it is related to these other relationships, is not always objective. The process of knowledge production is subjective because it's affected by other factors. And this way, it's also argued that there is no one way of knowing. There are many ways of knowing. And other ways of knowing are just as important. Probably to put it mildly, Professor Makhoba, the Vice Chancellor of the University of KwaZulu-Natal, at the Expo, in his opening speech, said, "You know, I go to my Sangoma when I have different needs for myself. I go to my medical doctor, we'll have different kinds of things. The fact, the issue is not which one of these is true. It's that all of them are true because they attend to different needs that we are looking at. So basically, when we look at the social construction of knowledge, the argument is that knowledge production cannot be as objective as it's claimed. It's subject to different kinds of activities. And this leads to the postmodern theories. This leads to to neoliberal economic theories. There's a link between that movement to the issue of celebrating the importance of these kinds of... So basically, maybe to summarize this, that it promotes the issue of probably individual persons in the knowledge. It pursues the openness. It pursues the issues of probably pushing market forces as an important element in the knowledge production. So this is the second. There is a new emerging paradigm of knowledge discussion, that all knowledge is local. There's no knowledge that is universal. That even what is called to be Western knowledge started as local knowledge. And then it was extended to other parts of the world. And therefore, the knowledge in the world is a network of local knowledges. And at different times, each knowledge becomes dominant. And therefore, they have equal standing. They should be given same respect rather than denigrating one and the other. And we think that if you're looking at indigenous knowledge in relationship to other knowledges, the benefit is that it does not try to put down other knowledges. It recognizes the value of Western knowledge. It will recognize the value of Chinese knowledge. Then it will also recognize the value of African traditional knowledge and say that these are as valuable and as useful as any other. And therefore, in this context, the methods that are involved in knowledge production in each one of these areas must be studied, codified, and respected. So we think that we are going through a new era of a new philosophy of knowledge production, which tends to speak more favorably to the production of indigenous knowledge. And I have a few points on that. And I think with that, we really want to thank you for your indulgence, for the time that you've given us. There are many issues that we have raised, but we are here with the team to be able to engage you on those issues. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor, and welcome the representatives of Solo Committee, whom I'm going to hand over to him. But as I'm doing that, in the mid-80s, when I was still working as a nurse, the patient that was admitted with CA of the stomach, and he was to go for a laparotomy for partial gastrectomy. But his relatives requested him to be taken to a somewhere. But the team refused because he was wasted and he needed to be rehabilitated first before going to. And then we allowed the somewhere to come, put him in a private room. So this somewhere would come from time to time. When he had to go for then a gastrectomy, I remember very well I was preparing all cases at the time. When he was then back from theater, so-and-so, when they were doing back from theater, laparotomy done, saline was out done. I said, no, this is the wrong patient. He said, no, it is. When he was opened, when they were to do the gastrectomy, no trace of malignancy was found. No trace. After a couple of years that he was done that. And we couldn't believe, doctors couldn't believe. And that then, as we said, as health workers, we attributed that to that sangoma. And when we went Nicodemus to the sangoma to find what is it that we have used, and he said, I was given by my ancestors this medicine, and I was told never to pass it to somebody else. And that man, when we used to tap on him, and he left, he was well, started to work after a couple of years. I'm saying that the power of the unfortunate part is that our people don't want to. It is all the politics. I don't want to bore the portfolio, but I'm reminded about that in a couple of them. I'm going to hand over to the chair of the portfolio committee. And as we have said earlier, that the practice and the norms that we allow members to ask questions. I'll hand over to you, Chair, for that.
You can still keep sitting here so that if there's anything you're around here, because I came halfway. First of all, good morning, everybody, and apologies for coming late. I'm from a conference. I'm sure those who watch the news in the morning, they saw me. It's a very important conference on the Academy of Sciences of Africa, which is taking place in Somerset West. I actually left it because I have heard that the whip whom I had asked to chair this meeting was also having a family problem, so I thought that there would be nobody here, and I had already passed the message that we would start at 10:30 because I left from the hotel straight to here. So apologies for that, but I'm happy that the group was able to really take you as also her priority, despite her very, very serious family situation. Well, without wasting time, I think the chief director has said it mouthful, but he has thrilled me with the last philosophical aspect. That is what I like the indigenous knowledge systems for, because they bring back the philosophy of humanity. And I remember that in one of the conferences in Durban, which was where we were launching a Ubuntu strategy of the Moses Kotane Institute. I met this gentleman here in the middle, Mr. Chabalala, who gave a very, very moving philosophical background of this indigenous knowledge systems. And I hence asked that one day when we'll be having a session like this in Parliament on indigenous knowledge systems, he should come. It's unfortunate that I have not had him talk. Maybe he started talking before, but I would have liked that he just gives a brief background of where he comes from in terms of understanding these systems. I wonder if the committee can allow me a small bit of time to preface. It looks like there is an agreement from the committee. Can you give us the question that you gave?
I just want to sensitize, and I hope members will appreciate this. In FS 12 from Chocolate 1, there's a memorial service. We have lost one of our members of Parliament, the chair of the Caucus of the African National Congress. So you can do that, but that's why I would say you try to be brief.
Thank you, Chair. It's challenging to kind of conceptualize it, but the talk that I gave was Indigenous Knowledge, the Science of Ubuntu and Ubuntu of Science. And the argument was that in this planet, we all have various ways of perceiving life. And it doesn't really matter where you're coming from. The point is that there are basic principles which govern life, and as Africans, we knew that long time ago, and somehow because of what Prof was talking about, another knowledge system kind of tried to oppress what we knew. And the arguments that I was making in Durban was really on the basis of the ancient Egyptians as African people who had an advanced knowledge, but linking it to the Bantu of Southern Africa and the world of quantum physics. And that if we could understand ancient knowledge and modern science, then we'll understand that there's no way in which you can separate science and spirituality and art. The minute you do that, you are actually going against the basic fundamental principles of life and you're simply digging your own grave. That is why today most people see science as the main contributor to the destruction of the planet instead of really uplifting people. The other problem is that we're seeing spirituality as a way of power. If you look at what is happening in the Far East or in the Middle East, the final thing is that science again and or art is now used as something for profit and not something that we used to use to ease up life as a science. So in short, we're saying that we need to look into ourselves as holistic beings, understanding the mind, what is the mind, but also understanding that we are energetic beings, we're made out of energy. And finally, looking into the physical, and if we can link these three levels, then it would be easier for us to interact with the planet and the knowledges that are there. I hope this kind of helps you understand where I'm coming from. Thank you.
I think that was a good profile. This is what excited me in Durban, as you can hear. It's unfortunate that he has not gone deep as he did, because he was invited to the abstract. This is what you call an abstract. It gives you the whole universality of where he comes from and where he's going. I think that is what is important. And that is why I like, you know, I have no, there are very few instances where there is this articulation of indigenous knowledge systems in terms of the philosophical foundation of our beings. So that is where I get very great, especially when it gets connected to modern physics. One of the persons after I listened to him was in another conference in Johannesburg, Dr. Gabron from Gabron, who came also from the angle of the connectivity of this world in the energy dimension, and he looked at quantum physics, he looked at the traditions and everything, actually abstractly in the same way as he has related it. So that is why I like the knowledge system, because it starts to bring back the concept of where we come from and the concept of Ubuntu. Grand principle of humanity. So that's how. Otherwise, I just wanted to ask to know why this committee is pursuing the development of indigenous knowledge systems. Because actually, if you read the Timbuktu manuscripts, the ancient Timbuktu manuscripts of 1800. You'll find where they show the indigenous knowledge system being used to develop astronomy. And it's very interesting when you read all those kinds of things. So that is why I like that these systems should be made central in our committee, because it is at the center of the development of where we want to go. Right, and I will therefore allow members to interact with the presenters. And before that, but let's thank the chief, our committee whip, for the work well done. Thank you very much. I have the hands in that order: Honorable Shin, Honorable Mlau, Honorable Tilen.
Thank you, Chair. This is a very interesting presentation. Thank you very much for the wealth of knowledge that you've shared with us here. I'm also pleased that the department has taken the stand on the sui generis legislation for Indigenous knowledge, because I felt the IP bill was really, really inappropriate, and particularly, and you've touched on some of it here, so I want to sort of explore it a bit, with how do you actually determine the origination of Indigenous knowledge? And this is where the IP bill, I think, fell short, because, you know, things that have been in the sort of that community domain for a long time, very difficult to pin down to which nation, which tribe actually owns a melody, for example. You know, is it Swazi, is it Zulu, and if it's Zulu, which clan and which person? And I would tend to think that as soon as somebody starts to make money out of this, human greed will surface and there'll be rows over the origination of this. So I'd like you to please explain how you see that particular issue evolving. Then on page 11 of the handout we've got, when you describe the difference between the private rights and the sui generis, I think you said something along the lines that as long as the community keeps that knowledge active, they will have the rights to it, but should they let it lapse, then it becomes what? Public knowledge? Can anybody then pick it up and use it? And what happens if somebody picks it up and uses it again after it's lapsed for a couple of years? Do you actually then sort of prevent or deal with the issue of the community suddenly waking up and realizing that they perhaps didn't exploit it to its full potential and now want some reward for it? Was it my understanding that the degree, the Bachelor of Indigenous Knowledge Systems, is being done at Northwest University? Is that right? Is that where it is being done? No. It'll be launched, but you can have it anywhere? You can study it anywhere?
Which means that any university can adopt it.
Okay, yeah, because my question was going to be, how come you don't have a chair of Indigenous knowledge at Northwest University? if that's where the degree is being launched from. But perhaps you can expand that a little more. Yes, also, then you talked about the registering of sorghum, or the patenting of sorghum. Now, sorghum, as far as I understand, is a fairly widespread crop in Africa. How do you actually sort of determine who originated it or who owns the knowledge to it, and what impact will this have on sort of biotechnology developments of sorghum for drought resistance and disease resistance and genetically modified crops? I mean, how are you going to actually manage the development of a sort of indigenous crop into a new age crop, if I can call it that. I think that's fine for me. Thank you.
Thank you,
Chairperson. And also, thank you for the presentation, Prof. It was very interesting. Yeah, my question is that the challenges that you mentioned, do you maybe have any plans in place that can address those challenges? And the other question is the HIV/AIDS trials, what is the time frame? And do we maybe have people who have already finished their trial in time? Thank you.
Well, thanks very much, and also to appreciate the detailed report that we received. I just want to find out on the issue of the first on the issue of coordination, because it cuts across different departments. And you specifically mentioned around health, trade and industry, agriculture, and so on. And you made a point that the Department of Science and Technology focuses on its own specific mandate. It can only provide certain aspects, but it cannot actually get directly involved in departments, which I think it's a right approach. But just to say that I would not run the risk in the long run where information gets lost in certain departments information relating to these matters of indigenous knowledge, indigenous knowledge. So that we may not say the Department of Scientists might do it, but I think it might be important. I think you made a point. It might be important to have some form of structure that can actually deal with this aspect of coordination, so that it is able to monitor and evaluate the level at which implementation takes place. Because, for example, I was looking at one particular chart this morning where it talks about certain achievements, but I could realize that the focus was only on legislation adopted. It didn't really go further to explain what are the actual things. They might be there, but so I'm saying, therefore, that if you have a unit or a structure that actually focuses on it, it can be able, even when reports are generated, to be in more a little bit of a detail to understand actually what has been done in that regard. Second one is, in fact, just to say that I agree that the institutionalization of this IKS is the right way to go. I just want to say I agree with you, and I also agree that the oral knowledge, we must find a way of recording, documenting, preserving it, and so on, because it is the only way that can assist for people to be able to access the knowledge, the information, whenever and whenever they need it. So I think it's something that needs to be actually, I would say, if possible, speeded up. Now, you raised an issue about this knowledge, the recognition of the knowledge. Now, you see, we have these old habits, which I think were brought to us by the systems that were there in the past, to say what is indigenous is primitive and what is Western is civilization. Now, I think as we proceed, we are going to have to deal with these old habits, which then brings me to the question I want to raise, which says, is there a way that we can be able to tell, maybe not 100% accurately, but just to tell as to how many, maybe percentage-wise, of our people agree and subscribe and believe in this indigenous knowledge? Because I'm speaking about few people, especially those who revolve around the urban areas and cities of our country. And you must also understand, and here I have to be very careful, I'm not saying it in a derogatory way, but I think some churches advocate a particular way of thinking in terms of how people regard and relate to these indigenous knowledges, African medicine, and so on and so forth. So it is going to be a strong challenge as you move ahead to win, because as you influence society, as you try to put the matter on the international agenda, to say this knowledge is knowledge and must be recognized, and made a point earlier on that knowledge is knowledge, and it cannot be argued that it can be knowledge if it passes certain academic standards. Knowledge is knowledge, you know, irrespective of who actually produces it. It's knowledge as long as it can test the test of time, it can respond to certain challenges of the time. So my last question, therefore, my last comment will be in relation to what I said, in terms of, especially in terms of African traditional medicine and other things related to that. Currently, as we speak, is the market responding positively to those issues? for example, your medical aid system, and if someone is diagnosed by a traditional healer, will the medical aid system, for example, respond positively as it responds to Western kind of civilization? So finally, my last question really is whether have we moved from, are we still in an advocacy stage of spreading this knowledge, or can we say with certainty that we are already moving in, we can see progress, you know, physical progress in terms of our implementation of the knowledge has been there, it's collected, yes, knowledge is there, but in terms of moving practically to do certain things related to that knowledge, have we actually made some strides in that regard? Thanks.
There's another question from
here. Thank you, Chair. Mine is more on what has been covered with others. And have to say that you have raised the issues that I do think that if we indirect and ask questions will take us the whole day because of the interest and the interest of the subject. And thank you to see how passionate are you. I get a sense that the whole team, how passionate are you on IKS. But for me it's about the Department of Trade and Industry that has introduced the intellectual property laws, I mean the BS. And that DST is pursuing the development of a socialized bill to protect intellectual property stemming from IKS. And just a couple of questions. What input and comment has the DST provided to this bill? Does the DST support or not the bill? And you will request to give us some reasons. Will these two pieces of legislation complement each other? And what are the fundamental differences in relation to the protection of IKS between these two pieces of legislation? Among reasons that, remember that trade and industry is the Amendment Bill 8 of 2010. And I would also have to start to check with the DST to you on those questions. Thank you.
The final one, it's not necessarily a question, but it is just a brainstorming input. You have raised this a question that by virtue of being across the board science, is IKS probably needs to be debated where it's supposed to be located. I think that's a very important debate or point that needs to be considered by the department, since I know that for now it was tasked to be a lead department in coordinating the activities of the NICSO. But I'm of this, as if looking at the dynamics of government, the changing of departments from time to time to suit the challenges of the time, and also that the interest of various ministers may not be of the same level if located. Suppose this Department of Science and Technology was once the Department of Arts, Culture, Science and Technology. And it may, as the Department of Minerals and Energy is now the Department of Mineral Resources and the Department of Energy separate. So those dynamics seem to tell you that this very great effort may die away somewhere, probably at its advanced stage of development. I was just thinking that probably it is an opportune time that is really located under presidency. Because I think under presidency, first, it will have a national recognition. Secondly, whoever changes, but the presidency will always be there. And I think that is one of the things that you must look into, so that it is preserved, because it is of national importance, if not international importance. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. We will share the responses with my colleagues. I think that the first questions from Honorable Shinin, faced to Mr. Sukhanandan, can take that on the traditional knowledge in terms of determining the originality, nations, and the like, and the second one as well, especially the patent one referring to the sorghum aspects of that. And I presume that you place it within the context of the plant breeders' rights and the like. And then Mr. Chabalala will come to your area. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just to respond to the honourable member's question on the origin. Basically, Chair, this is our fundamental problem with the DTI bill, is that if you look at your conventional intellectual property rights, they accord individual ownership to in terms of the inventor, in terms of the patent law, they accord ownership to the inventor, so it's a single person. It excludes a particular community as such. And if you look at the copyright, it accords or grants ownership to an individual author or the originator of that work. Within the sui generis legislation, we are looking beyond individual ownership, looking at ownership collectively and at communal level. Going back to the issue of origin, the sui generis legislation will be guided by international protocols and international treaties that define what a particular community is. And we're looking more at communities that have historical continuity or pre-invasion aspects in terms of how do we define a particular community. But within the sui generis legislation, we are not tying ourselves up to any particular definition. Likewise, in terms of, and this relates to the question of private and public rights, is that we are also going to be guided in terms of definitions in terms of what is traditional knowledge. We are not tying ourselves to any particular definition, but we are looking at criteria that would satisfy the requirements for what constitute the nature of traditional knowledge or indigenous knowledge. And this brings us back to the issue of what Prof indicated are the three criteria, and these three criteria are the African position that we've tabled at WIPO, is that firstly, it has to be intergenerational, it must be embedded in a particular local community, and it must have a communal aspect to it. So as long as honorable member, as long as that community satisfies these three criteria, it will remain protected. Once these criteria fall off, then protection will actually fall off. So as long as it's community held, it's embedded in a particular cultural community context, or if it's intergenerational, it will satisfy the requirements for protection. And Chair, this, I just want to come back to the question of the honourable member. Yes, we did, in terms of coming back to the issue, we did submit a 25-page response to the DTI bill. We have that if you want to have a look at that. In terms of whether it's in opposition to the DTI bill, no, it's not in opposition. It complements the DTI bill, as we mentioned earlier, that the sui generis legislation sees the protection of indigenous knowledge from a holistic perspective. It includes moral rights, customary rights, and economic rights, whereas the amendment to the DTI bill only seeks the economic or the commercial aspect of protection. We think it's beyond the commercial and beyond the economic aspect. Our fundamental problem with the DTI bill is that A, we have problems with the duration, and as Prof indicated, is that if you look at the patent laws or the copyright laws, in terms of patent laws, it's 15 to 20 years. If you look at copyright, it's the protection is life plus 50 years. And it brings back to our presentation is that in all your Western or your current intellectual property right tools are bundles of relationships. And once you sell that, you bring that relation to an end. For example, let me give you an example. Indigenous knowledge has been brought back from a number of generations. It has existed some time immemorial. If you sell that after 20 years, or you put that into the public domain, you lose that. You lose the secrecy, and you lose that sacredness. So what we are saying is that protection must be held in perpetuity, to hold the sacredness and to hold that secrecy. Secondly, the issue, if you come back to copyright, you need to find the original owner. Given the fact that indigenous knowledge has transcended a number of generations, you don't have the originator of that story or that tale. So hence, it does not satisfy. Your current legislation cannot satisfy the idiosyncrasies of indigenous knowledge. And hence, we are saying we are moving away from the criteria of material form and individual authorship. In terms of the registration of SOGAM, I just want to link this up with an issue that we are currently having with the Nestle. Nestle has filed five patents on the rooibos and honeybush. And in terms of our bioprospecting regulation, they needed to enter into an access and benefit sharing agreement, which they actually didn't do. So If those patents were granted at the EPO, then it would have effectively stopped all research regarding the honey bush and the rooibos. So what the solutions they say, it moves beyond that. So it would not stop the issue of bioprospecting. The invention, the innovation will actually continue. So I hope that answers the question on that. Coming back to the issue of coordination, sir, is that the establishment of the interdepartmental committee is a policy imperative. It's embedded in the policy. The terms of reference of this interdepartmental committee has 14, and each department that has an interest in IKS is represented on the board. For example, if you look at the Department of Education, which has the interest of the integration of IKS into the curriculum, is represented. If you look at the Department of Environmental Affairs, which has the issues of genetic resources and biological diversity associated with indigenous, are actually represented. So every part, we even have indigenous mining. So they are also represented. So in terms of coordination, all government departments come together once every quarter, and we discuss projects. And the expo, which is actually an initiative that emerged or emanated out of this coordination of different departments. The other issue that the nation's community, in terms of the buy-in, we have embarked on a project with the Human Science Research Council. it's part of the South African Social Attitude Survey. Within the survey, we are trying to ascertain what type of support or what type of buy-in that we have from the South African community, and this project is rolled out into the 9 different provinces. Prof, have I left out anything that you need?
On the sorghum part of the question is that these seeds were collected in the 1930s and put into a seed bank. Now, at that time, there's no way that there could have been a benefit sharing agreement. It was too early, and the collection of it was for the protection for generations to come. It was not to commercialize. So what the USA was attempting to do is to go contrary to the rules set for the seed bank and then appropriate that issue of sorghum because they see a great potential for commercial gains on that. And so indeed, it is those kinds of issues that need to be looked at. Now, in terms of the plant varieties, there is ways in which these, and that's within our act, which if we're looking at the DTI bill, does not address in terms of the plant varieties. The protection of indigenous plants is included in there. And then the derivative rights that will be obtained from the research thereof is also indicated. Should a biotech company take one of those and research it further, those will be derivative rights that will be then attributed to the biotech. So it does not stop any further research, but it just lays down the rules in which to operate. Then there are also ways in which the originality of these sorghum varieties could be plotted in terms of the migration and all that, because it's been recorded. That's why they collected them quite early, check the migration and all that. So there is a way in which research could establish some of the originality of this. Let's take an example of maize. We all know that although it seems as if it is indigenous to Africa, it's actually from Latin America. It's not indigenous to Africa. So there could be ways in which all these things could be ascertained in terms of their originality. So to a certain extent, there are provisions which can assist us. And there are also provisions not to use the protection of indigenous knowledge as a way of stopping further research, but rather as an enabling tool. As you recognize the previous rights, then you can build on them. So it's the foreground rights and the background rights. And so there could be provision that we could work towards around those issues. We aim that our role is to promote research, development, and innovation. So we should align our legislation to facilitate that. Thank you. Mr. Chabalala could tackle the issues around HIV, AIDS, traditional medicines, responses to the change. On the complementarity?
What are the advantages? What are the differences?
Sorry, Chair, just a very last aspect of your question, which I think now that I didn't respond to, you asked what is the difference between the DTI and us. And basically, if I have to summarize it, I would summarize it more into the advantages of the SUIGENES legislation. In fact, legislation was used currently very effectively in Panama and Costa Rica. And they have also a regional, in the Latin American country, it's called the Executive Order 391, and it's been used very successfully. And it is used successfully because there's flexibility in terms of the definition. The scope of protection is much larger. The duration of protection is in perpetuity. Also, it takes into account the different treaties and protocols. Unlike if you look at your patent laws only look at your Paris Convention, your copyrights look at the Berne Convention, whereas you have a hybrid rare or an eclectic combination of different protocols in one legislation. So that is a key advantage of a Swiss. The other advantages are it takes issues of disclosure. It takes issues of disclosure of origin, disclosure of the knowledge. It also brings into the fray issues of prior informed consent, issues of access and beneficiary, and issues of mutually agreed terms. So these are the issues which the DTI bill does not address. But also very importantly, it ensures that the suit legislation ensures that the DTI bill only has positive protection of indigenous knowledge, whereas the sui generis has both. It has the defensive protection as well as positive protection. And in conclusion, I just want to add that the sui generis legislation will also bring the issues of trans-border protection into consideration as well, given that most of our indigenous knowledge transcends different borders. So hence, in terms of national treatment and reciprocal international arrangements, that these indigenous knowledge which reside in different countries will be brought under one legislation.
I just want to warn you that we are almost running out of time now. If you can summarize your responses, because it's almost 22 minutes past 12, and according to what I have gathered, is that at half past 12 we are supposed to be somewhere. Yeah, thank you.
Tabarala will give a minute or so response, and I also give a minute of summing up.
Thank you. I'll just
switch off.
I'll respond to, I think it's three things. The first one, I just wanted to add on the BIKS issue, that the BIKS actually it's one of the deliverables of the upcoming Center of Excellence on Indigenous Knowledge Systems, and we're just waiting for the NRF to finalize the recommendations of the review. So we should be launching that next year as well. And in there, we may have chess if there is money. And then on the HIV issues, is that the main study is on Switzerlandia by the Western Cape, UKZN, and I think Argentine Hospital. They completed phase two of the clinical trials, and they are now going to phase three. I cannot say what the timelines are, because there are glitches along the way, but the plan is that this study should be completed by next year. The other study that has been completed is at the MRC. It was really an observation a trial. It was completed, and the results are very, very good, and that can be taken into the clinical trial 3 as well. And I must also mention that tomorrow, Dr. Mazarisa is going to the MCC to present some of the new protocols that he developed out of these studies that we're funding. So if those ones go through, then that will open up new epistemologies in terms of clinical research and traditional medicine in the country. Then on the issue of the numbers, how many people, it's really difficult, but the data that is running out there, it's mainly in relation to traditional medicines or the use of traditional healers or health practitioners. People talk about 79-80% of South Africans that they go to traditional healers before they go to clinics. We don't know if that number is true at the moment. And finally, yes, knowledge is knowledge, and we feel that the most important thing is that we need to continue with the systematization. That's what we have a chair on knowledge systems studies, and we need to relanguage this knowledge, because people feel that something is primitive because we don't have the relevant language at this time, and it may seem like we're upgrading that which is ancient, and there is resistance also from the knowledge holders, but it's important for us to relanguage and use let's say, scientific way of explaining things, then it would be easier for people to see some of the things that they believe in crumble before their faces, and also their experiences as well. Thank you.
Chair, thank you very much. I think the challenges that have been raised in terms of the campaign for us to persuade people to believe in IKS is a very big challenge. But we are proud to say that within the DST, its integration into the 10-year innovation plan is a clear indication of broader acceptance. So we will continue to work around the campaign. We have moved out of advocacy. As you can see, we are now in institutionalization of IKS. We're building institutions around IKS, and we'll continue with that. And probably on the recognition, we agree with your observation. It will require a lot of work to build a system that recognizes all these communities. We are starting the journey. We don't know how it will end in terms of that long process. But finally, this is a much more overall comment in terms of how do we relate to the DIT bill. We definitely support the issue to stop biopiracy through amendment of aspects that refer to the commercial side of it. And to that extent, I think that their effort would go a long way. But in so doing, there are areas which are problematic. One of them is the ownership of that indigenous knowledge cannot be appropriated by the state. It must remain with the knowledge holders. It's a crucial point of disagreement, and probably very difficult to compromise on, because we see that the knowledge ownership must remain with communities. The second point of serious disagreement, which we will work towards reconciling, is the period from which IKS can be protected. The proposal on the table says from 1968, the IKS from 1958 to the present could be protected. But it's a contradiction to the principles of IKS generation and transmission. It goes over generations. So there are points on which it is impossible to support the bill unless there is a change in the mindset on building principles. One of them is ownership and the coverage. So I thought that it is important for us to state those clear categories of the IKS policy. And then to say that in time span, we have met with the DTI after all this presentation. We've placed support, and we're working on those three areas, including the database, so that we can reconcile them before they come back to the DTI portfolio committee. So we're working together on that issue. So finally, is that we have also agreed that they should proceed with this amendment. Thereafter, they will also be part of leading the sui generis protection as an aspect of it. So we are not excluding one from the other, but seeing them as complementing each other, and that we'll work together as a team. But let's go ahead with the first one, complete it, and then we can do the second one. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Unfortunately, time does not allow us now to continue, but it's quite an interesting discussion, which we think that it's not exhausted today. We still need to develop it, but I would also remind you in front of this committee that we made a pledge in Durban Expo that it would be before the end of the year, host another kind of national workshop. I do not know how far that effort has gone, because we promised people, they were very excited. You said it mouthful yourself. And you allowed us, together with the chair of health, to give them the promise that we will come back before the end of the year, if all things be equal. So I think you must then address that question. Thank you very much. I think the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
And this is in June, September.